Hi, I'm Linda, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Billy for asking me to speak, and if you've heard my story, I'm really sorry because it really hasn't changed much over the years, but maybe some different understandings of things. My sobriety date is 8/8/89. I belong to the Wholesale Miracle Group, which meets on Tuesday night in Charlottesville. I have a sponsor who sponsors tons of women who has a sponsor. So my story starts around, I'm going to talk about my drunkalogue for a bit because it talks about in the big book in a general way what happened, what it was like, what happened, what it's like now, those three things. And so around 25 was my worst year. I've had some trouble somewhere in my early 20s. I got my first drunk driving. You know, I'd had been stopped many times for drunk driving and let go because, you know, it's not a big a thing as it is today because so many people are dying in drunk driving accidents. And so at 25, which was in 1987, I accrued my second drunk driving somewhere around my birthday, which is in March. I think it was in the month of March. Everything's kind of foggy. And a series of events happened from March until January of 1988 that led me to get sober. And so it went something like this. You know, so I love to drink. That I am pretty much your garden variety alcoholic, although I have tried some of its outside issues. But if I'm spending my money and I want to do what I do, I drink in a bar room with my money, sitting on a bar stool. I don't like drinking at home. I don't like drinking alone. I don't want to drink in your backyard. I love bar rooms. And so at 25, you know, I get arrested for a drunk driving. I lose my license for 6 months. I'm a loser, you know. I'm riding a bike to a bus to go to a downtown law firm in Boston, a big law firm working for a major partner, because I've lost my license. And in Massachusetts in 87, they instituted this new law that if you get caught driving after revocation, it was a mandatory 1 year. I was driving after revocation, and my parents found out, and my mother begged me not to do that, that they couldn't deal with the fact that if I ended up in jail. So I parked my car in their driveway for 16 months, and it was awful. And so my mother looked at me and said, and I am not taking you anywhere. And she didn't. And she is not a hardcore Al-Anon by any means. My mother loved us and fixed things for us for a long time until we could love ourselves. And she has two kids. She has my brother who's 4 years older than me that's alcoholic, you know. Then there's me who's alcoholic. I have two parents that are not alcoholic, but their parents and, you know, generations back, it like skipped their generation and came down to all the cousins and their kids. And so she had no idea what alcoholism looked like or what it was about, and she really thought it was all her fault. And it was something to do with her parenting, that she had such rotten kids. And that wasn't true. So I didn't get rides from my mother. I would, you know, ride my bike to this ice cream store. I would chain the bike up. I would pop the tire off because if I'd lost my bike, I wouldn't be able to get there. I would grab a bus. It was insane. And it was very embarrassing. I used to walk around always saying, loser, loser. And that went on for 16 months, you know. And part of that trip was that I was supposed to go to a state-funded run treatment center offered to me by the state of Massachusetts. So that would be my first and only incarceration, because if I had a choice of not going, I would have opted out. It was mandatory. And so women only went like every other month because there were far less women drunks than there were male drunks. And I was one of the requisites is you're supposed to show up sober. And believe it or not, it was my best childhood's friend's wedding on a Saturday night before the Sunday I was to arrive into this mandatory sober treatment center, state-funded treatment center. And needless to say, I showed up very drunk, made a huge scene at her wedding, was totally and absolutely so ill-mannered, and just, I behaved so badly, it was terrible. And I had passed out, like, on the garage floor, which was, like, her husband's man cave. We were all drinking out there. Somebody, I don't remember any of this, somebody picked me up and put me in her bed, my best friend's bed, because she was leaving to go on her honeymoon, and she said it was her husband. And then somebody came in to wake me up at 5 o'clock because I had to go to this treatment center in Plymouth, Mass., which was kind of far from where I was. I show up drunk, and they're like, they give you this litmus paper test or something. You put it in your mouth. It turns funny colors, and they're like, you're intoxicated. And I'm like, pretty much. And they're like, you got to go. And I didn't really much care, right? Because I knew I was not going to drink at my best friend's wedding. That was like impossible. It wasn't even a thought. So I go home and, you know, I do things that really upset my parents. Like I hitchhike home, which my mother thinks is terribly dangerous. And I keep telling her, I'm fairly selective, you know, two guys in a case of beer stop one day to pick me up. I'm like, yeah, no, I'm not getting in that car. I'm a little bit selective. I don't get in the back seat. But anyway, I come home and my mom's like, what are you doing here? You're supposed to be in treatment. And I was like, I'm drunk. They won't take me. So that's an automatic sentence in jail. That's a violation of my probation. My probation officer sort of liked me. And so my story is lots of people have given me lots of breaks. There's been a lot of breaks through my life. Now, I don't believe that's God's grace because I just think that's dumb luck. And I think that, you know, me not killing anybody in a drunk driving accident, I drove drunk every night, and my mother abhors drunk drivers, and she had a chronic daughter that drove drunk all the time. I just thought, like, it wasn't going to happen to me. That's how I live with that. I'm like, that's never going to happen to me. And that is, again, dumb luck. That has nothing to do with me and anything else. It was just dumb luck. And so I come home, and he doesn't send me, and I go the following month. And there's two things I took away from that. They gave you all these stupid tests, you know, the questions kind of like the pamphlet. And I'm like, and then they're like, oh, middle stage is alcoholism. And I'm like, 25. I'm like, oh, whatever. Okay, you know, and they didn't really look at it. I could be honest on it. I'm like, oh, whatever. Don't really care. And the other thing I remember was that a young boy came in. He was 17 years old, and he had killed his best friend in a drunk driving accident, and he was driving. And part of his probation and Mother Against Drunk Driving is that he had to go tell a story at these treatment centers, like, you are eligible too, yet. And I didn't believe in yet, because, you know, for some reason, they weren't going to happen to me. And so, but I remember feeling terrible. Like, you know, I can't imagine what it would be like if I woke up and killed my best friend whose wedding, her name was Jean, and killed her in a car accident because we drove drunk all the time. So that stuck with me. And then AA meetings came in, and it was back in the 80s when they were an hour and a half, and it was the longest hour and a half of my life. It felt like a week, and I just didn't get how it worked. I thought it was stupid. I didn't think, like, listening to somebody up here was going to have anything to do with my alcoholism, and I couldn't make the connection. Plus, at that point, I didn't really want to, you know. And so, I don't know, months, so, you know, my life is blipping along, and somewhere in September, I caused this horrific, and this was, like, my biggest secret on my four-step, mess at my mom's house in front of my mom. The only saving grace of that night was my dad wasn't home to witness that. Maybe if my dad was home, it wouldn't have happened. I don't know. But thank God he was never there. So I don't remember how I left. I don't remember who picked me up. I remember, unfortunately, what had happened there, which in parts of it, in the worst parts of it. And when I was making my amends to my mom, I talked about that, and she said to me, because it was years later, and she said to me, I often wondered if you remembered that night. And I'm like, unfortunately, that would have been a great place to be in a blackout. But that was the tipping point for me, was that event, because all of my moral, there was such a moral slide there that it horrified me. It wasn't even horrified. I was so shit. I was so filled with shame that I couldn't look at my mom and I couldn't go back to the house. I was living there because, you know, I'd move out, go back, you know, depending on how the money went, you know, how I spent the money. So I moved out and I never went back. And because I couldn't look at her, you know, I just couldn't look at her. And I will tell you, at the end of my drinking, it was the loneliest time of my life. I didn't have one personal connection except with my family. And it's because my mom and my dad, when I say my mom, because she just called more often, but it's my mom and my dad, that whole unit, is the only one that kept the connection. If they didn't keep the connection, I wouldn't have had a single human connection, except probably with my best friend, Jean, whose wedding I caused a disaster at. And then, so that happens. And now I'm filled with shame, and I'm like, what the heck am I going to do now? So I move out of the house, I go to work, I've got this great job that I love, working for this man that I adore. He's just one of the nicest people in the world, and he's a great part of my story. December comes along, and this is the end of my drunk along. I go to Florida by myself to bring in the new year. You know, I'm not a morning drinker yet. You are eligible too. I'm a morning drinker on vacation. So, you know, around 10 o'clock, I start drinking. It's New Year's Eve. I run into somebody I had dated for a while. But, I mean, I was, like, blind drunk, you know, like, couldn't even focus. I had one hand over my eye, and I asked him this question that only he would know the answer to. And I'm like, oh, it is you. But if I had to identify him, like, I couldn't even focus. That's how drunk I was. It was after midnight, and I had started at 10. And so we hang out, and that's a whole horror show. And that's just another ugly event of all the ugly events at the end of my drinking. And I really liked this guy. And one of the reasons I stopped seeing him before I ran into him there was because he was a nice guy. And I knew I wasn't a nice person. I didn't know how to articulate this, or maybe subconsciously, but I didn't really verbalize it until I got into Alcoholics Anonymous. But the way I lived my life is I did whatever I wanted with whoever I wanted, wherever I wanted, no matter who it hurt. Now, I would have denied that, but as I got in here and I looked at my behavior, and even I could see the slide by this point to such a place that I couldn't stand who I had become, that I was like, oh, my God. And I probably would have denied that, but that's what I had become at the end of my drinking. And so I knew I wasn't a nice person, and he was a nice guy. And I just didn't want to take him down that road. I didn't want to go down that road with him. And my drinking looked like this. I didn't date anybody that required me to do anything. I didn't want to go to a family event. I didn't want to show up at a wedding. I didn't want any sort of ties. I wanted to do what I wanted whenever I wanted. So I didn't want any connection with anybody that expected me to be somewhere or do something with them, family-wise, at all. I showed up at all my families, mostly, but I didn't want that in my life. I wanted to be where I wanted to be when I wanted to be there. So December, it's a whole mess. It's ugly. I come in. I almost miss my flight. And Boston is snowed in, and I can't get from the airport to my house. So I end up going into this downtown law firm, sleeping in the bathroom in the ladies' room because they have a couch. I come out in the morning, and they're like, there's no place to shower. I go to work, and they're just kind of looking at me, and I'm like, whatever. This is what it looks like when I drink. And I was starting to have a whole lot of trouble. And for me, my biggest measuring stick for alcoholism for me was employability. I kept really good jobs, working for really good people, doing really interesting things that I enjoyed. And I got home like January 4th or 5th, 4th maybe, 3rd or 4th. And by the 8th, I was going to rehab in 1988. So what happened was I get home, and Joe calls me. He's one of my fellow, you know, compatriots that we go out and do what we do. And we went on a three-day run, which I've never done, and I didn't call into work, and I didn't show up. That's something I have never done in all my drinking, and that really bothered me. So at one point, I sent him home, and I said, look, I'm sick. I don't feel good. And I had an apartment at the time, but my mother has her house, my mom and dad, and they have a full-stocked bar all the time. They have more booze than they'll ever drink in a lifetime. And so we went to my mom's house on the three-day run every night because there was just booze there all the time. So we would stay there because nobody was there. My parents were on vacation. And my father said after I got sober, he didn't have to replace the Kahlua, the vodka, and a lot of other in the beer since I stopped drinking. It lasts far longer now. We would just go in there and steal it, too, sometimes if we weren't done. I'd go in, I'd take a lid and just leave. And so I sent him off, and he came back an hour later with some outside issues, and he said, come on. And I'm like, okay, I'm not drinking here. If you want to continue, we're going to go to the bar. And it's like 8 a.m., and where I live, we have bar rooms. Like, they don't serve food. They just serve liquor, and it's strictly made for alcoholics, and it's like double, you know, pickled eggs. There's nothing there but booze, nothing. You just go there to drink, and we're the ones that keep it in business, and that's not like in Virginia. I could never have been alcoholic here. So I went to the bar, and I kept saying to the bartender, tell me when it's 10 o'clock, I'll go get the bus. Tell me when it's this, I'll go get the bus, and I never go. And so a lot of stuff happens that day that's not really important. But one of the things I notice is I go in the bathroom, it's like 2 or 3 in the afternoon. I look, I'm all pasty white. I look like I'm dying. I've been out for 3 days, and I was like, oh, my God. I can't do this anymore. And what I noticed is I sat down and I lifted my head up off of my drink, and what I saw were very separate people sitting on very separate bar stools, very much alone and very old. It was an old man's bar. It literally was. They were all white-haired, smoking cigarettes, drinking themselves to death. And nobody was talking to anybody. And I'm like, that's my future. And I'm 25 years old. And I'm like, I want to be married. I want to have kids. You know, I want, you know, the white picket fence, the two cars, you know, I want all of those things. I had dreams. And I'm like, who's going to want me? And 2 years before this, my brother got sober. So I'm running out the door in this panic because I have had trouble with drinking. When I got my second drunk driving in 87, I went to an AA meeting. I cried through the whole thing. I'll never forget. It's called East Side Improvement. They were so nice. They gave me a bumper sticker. I was mortified. I didn't want anybody to know. They gave me a book. The more the nicer they were, the harder I cried. And I just didn't want to belong. I just didn't want this to be my solution at 25. I wanted to drink. What my solution I wanted was, how can I drink and not get into trouble? That's what I wanted my solution to be. So this did not appeal to me at 20, you know, well, it was still 25 at that point when I thought I'd come check you out. And so I heard a guy say years after when I got sober that he thought the cure was worse than the disease. And that's what it was like for me when I went to that meeting at East Side Improvement. The cure coming here was worse than being a drunken buffoon. But, you know, several months later, being a drunk was far worse than coming here. You know, it flipped for me. So I go and I check it out. Doesn't work out for me. I don't want to go. It's January. It's a mess. I run out of the bar in the afternoon, and some guy's walking in saying, what's wrong? And I'm like, I got to get out of here. And so for me, I've always considered I've had a problem with alcohol, but the sun would come up, and it'd be a new day, and I would be like, that was just a bad night. That's an overcorrection if I think I need to come here, you know. It would just somehow be okay in the morning when the sun was up. It's always worse around 2 a.m. and it's dark. But in the morning, I would be like, oh, that won't happen again, whatever I'd say. So off I run, and he takes me home, and I call my brother, and I say, who's living – nobody's in the state. My mother's in Europe, and my dad's in Europe. My brother lives in Florida, and I'm at their house, not even at my own house, own apartment. And I'm like, you need to call somebody here and get me help. And so I, self-willed one right, which I didn't even know what that meant for years, but anyway, had this rosy picture of how I wanted to get sober, and God had a different plan, which is what kept me in Alcoholics Anonymous to this day. So my plan was, my brother had gotten sober at Edgehill, Newport, Rhode Island. It was lobster and steak and these really high-end, you know, 30-day programs, and it was really posh, and that's what I wanted, and I wanted to go for 30 days. I wanted this. I wanted that. And I said, you need to get me help. And so my insurance from my job said, you're really not that bad. We want you in an IOP. Now, I know for me, as sick as I've been many, many, many nights leaving work, I wanted to go home because I was so tired. But it was like my car's on automatic pilot, and it would be in front of the bar again. I'm like, it's like I have that mental blank spot. Like, I didn't drive here. When I left work, the plan was to go home because I was so tired. And once I got in front of the bar again, it was like, well, I'm here. I might as well go in. Now, I wasn't one of those either. I don't believe in that says, I used to go in for one. I used to say all the time, let's get drunk. And my mother would say, who says that? And I'm like, who doesn't? I mean, like, I never said, let's go get a drink. It was always on the, let's go get drunk. And so, like, I don't drink a drink. So I end up in front of the bar. I go in, and it's whatever. It's all over. So I said, you need to get some help for me because the sun's going to rise in the morning, and I'm going to just think this is a bad night. So he makes some phone calls, and we try to get the insurance thing done. And we're fighting with the insurance companies, and I can't go. I call my parents in Europe, and I say to my mother that I won't be home when you get home. And I did a lot of geographical cures by myself at a very young age. Like, I left home at 18 to go cross country with $400 and an AMC Gremlin. My father sobbed like uncontrollably. My dad doesn't cry. He felt like I was going to be killed, and he was right, only because I was so drunk on that trip. I can't tell you how many car wrecks I was in. Anyway, so she's like, where will you be? And I was like, I'm having trouble. I'm going to go get help. And she's like, and she's never done this. She keeps my father, talk to your dad. And I'm like, damn. So she gives the phone to my father, and I explain that I'm going away, and he said, can you wait till you get home? We'll be home tomorrow night. Can you just hold on till tomorrow? I said, okay. So I hang up the phone, arguing with insurance companies. I'm not getting my way. The phone rings, and I'm at my parents' house. And it's my boss from the job that I truly adore that he wasn't in my life, I probably wouldn't have got sober. But anyway, when I picked up the phone, I didn't think it would be him. I thought he'd be calling my house at where I used to, you know, my apartment. So I picked up the phone thinking it was my brother or it was my mom, and I heard, hello. And, like, my heart stopped. And he's like, I think you owe me an explanation. And I said, I'm having trouble with alcohol and drugs, is what I said to him. I'm having trouble with alcohol and drugs, and I'm going to get help. And he's like, really? I'm like, yes. And I remember sobbing, and that was the first time I said it, that I meant it to somebody other than a family member. And I felt terrible. And he's like, well, I said, my parents are, you know, I guess they get in at 6. By the time they clear customs, they'll be home at 8 p.m. I don't know, it was like 10 in the morning maybe. And he's like, well, what do you want to do? And I'm like, I don't know. Might as well get drunk, because it's the last time I can get drunk. And so when I don't know what to do and I'm unsure, I sort of get flippant and sort of get, you know, I just get sassy. And he's like, Linda. And I'm like, well, you know, if I really, I'd like to come to work and, you know, finish out the day. And he said, you come in today, get my affairs in order, and we'll talk. And I went in that morning, I got on the bus, did all that nonsense, and I went to work, and he told me if I got sober and stayed sober, he'd let me keep my job. That was a true gift for me. So my parents get home, and we're having this talk, like, I need an adult timeout. Back home, we call it, like, jail and adult timeout. Like, God gives us so many chances, and we just don't pick them. Sometimes we just don't pick them up. And finally, he puts us in jail, and he makes us sit still long enough. And I needed an adult timeout. Like, I needed to be in a hospital where I couldn't get in my car. And I am absolutely certain I would not have gotten Alcoholics Anonymous at 25 by walking through the door. I didn't really want it. So my father, who I adore, is just a blue-collar worker, or, you know, your average working-class Joe, not a lot of money. We always came first. His whole life is family first. He's German. You know, he's, you know, first-generation immigrant. And I really wanted to go somewhere, so I wanted 30 days. So we looked around, and my dad said to me, I'll never forget this. I cry every time I think about it. He said, look, we can't afford to pay for you to go 30 days, but I can pay for you to go for 14. And so that's what they did. And so they emptied their savings account, and it really just breaks my heart because, like, we're the worst bet in town, if you ask me, right? So I'm like, oh, God. So, you know, he takes me, him and my mom, they take me for my last meal. I'm like, my dad loves to eat in gin mills, so we go to this gin mill, of course. And I'm looking at the booze on the thing, and I'm like thinking, like, oh my God, what have I done? I can't do this. I don't want to do this. I'm in a full-blown panic, right? The bottles look pretty. They're singing to me, and I'm like, oh, I can't imagine life without it. And so I go, and I went to Gosnell, which is down on Cape Cod in Falmouth, and it says on the sign, a bridge back. And I was in my head, I get really nasty, I'm like, a bridge back top. And I'm like, that is the stupidest thing I've ever seen, and I don't understand, whatever. And so I had this dialogue going in my head, which was very unkind, and I entered the program, and I was sober. So I had to spend 3 days on the detox side, and I was sober. It was the longest 3 days of my life before I get over to the treatment side. And I can remember, so I went in January 8th, 1988, and I can remember it was snowing, and they let us walk around the building. I felt like such a jerk. That's all we could do. And so I remember being out there in my head saying, if the insurance company had paid for this, I would leave. It is my dad's money. He worked so hard for it. He doesn't have a lot. I owe it to him to finish. I cannot believe I would walk right to the end of the street, because at the end of the street is that place that we had lunch, and there's booze there. And I was mad. So the first week, I didn't really pay attention or do anything that I was supposed to do, and they were thinking about kicking me out. And the second week, I sort of did, unbeknownst to me, one of not the big one, but one of my shame factors, I sort of dropped that out there. And so sort of like my fourth and fifth, I did one thing and I dropped that there, and there was such relief from that, because there was so much shame wrapped around whatever I dropped there. So there was relief for me, and I felt a little bit better, and I spent the last week doing what I was supposed to. When I was at this program, you know, I had two drunk drivings, and so the only two people they could, Massachusetts sent me to that program, and then they sent me for an on and after program. I had to see an alcohol counselor. So the only two people that came and saw me in treatment were my parents and this alcohol counselor. And so one important factor was, I don't know if this is true, but this is what my brother and my father said. I had called my dad and I said, this place is a, and I swore, and you have to come get me, Daddy. It's a terrible place. It's awful. And so my brother called, you know, pretty much right after that, and he was saying, we have to go get your sister. It's a terrible place. And my brother said, leave her there. That's where she needs to be. And he left me, and it broke his heart to leave me there. He really thought it was a terrible place. I thought it was a terrible place. And he left me, and that was another one of, you know, the grace of God. God doing for me what I can't do for myself? My parents' pain, I didn't walk out. I am sure that I would have worked out God doing for me what I can't do for myself, right? I didn't get my way any way that I wanted it, and it was perfect. So I stay there, and, you know, the alcohol counselor comes, and he says, when you get out of here, I'll take you to your first meeting on the street. Now, in Massachusetts, we have a book. It's huge. We have a meeting on every third corner, almost as many Starbucks as is around here, or Dunkin' Donuts in Massachusetts. They're everywhere. And he circled meetings, so he took me to my first meeting on the street. And so in treatment, I went to meetings, which I hated again. I didn't understand. It was the longest hour and a half of my life. I would count tiles. I'd read the paper. I'd talk to the kid next to me. I was just so not into any of it. And he took me to my first meeting, and the only thing I remember about that first meeting on the street, it was the same people that came into my treatment center, and they stunk there, and they were worse the second time I heard them. And then he gave me a meaningless book, and he said, I want you to go to this meeting. And the next meeting was Sunday, and it was Sunday morning, Brockton High School. There were like 200 people there. It was awesome, right? I don't remember anything about that meeting, but again, God doing for me what I can't do for myself. I walk through the door, and this guy by the name of Rick comes up, and he's like, you must be new. And I'm like, maybe it's the angry face thing going on, you know? And I'm like, what do you mean? And he's like, you're new, right? And I'm like, yeah. And you know, I'm having a dialogue with him and a dialogue in my head. I'm being extremely polite and saying all the proper answers. And in my head, I'm saying something like, get the heck away from me. I really don't want to be talking to you. Could you just mind your own business? And I'm like, it's very nice to meet you, blah, blah, blah. And he's like, I think you should meet this woman. And I'm thinking, like, I don't want to meet anybody. Could you just go away? Yes, that would be lovely. I go meet the lady. And he's like, I think she's being a sponsor. And I'm saying, I don't want a sponsor. Go away. I meet the woman. I'm very polite. Lovely to meet you, Anne-Marie. Thank you very much. You know, I'm going to go sit over there. So I go sit over there. And the only thing I remember about that meeting is Jimmy Pirelli got his 19-year medallion. So I literally was 19 days sober on the street, and he got his 19-year medallion. And I used to count my years next to his. Mine is one. He's got 20. And it's 21. So I was like, that's just rubbish. I didn't believe that for a second, that Jimmy had 19 years. I just thought it was rubbish. I didn't think it was even conceivable. So, but those are the things I took away from that first meeting, right? And so I get on the bus to go to work, and who's on the bus that's probably been on the bus for the last 6 months I've been on the bus is Anne-Marie, the woman that he thinks should be my sponsor. I just want to kill myself. So I say to her, hello, hello. And I was like, how do you find a sponsor? And now she was so plugged into AA, it was ridiculous. So she was part of the Grapevine. She comes on the bus the next day with this Grapevine article. I read the article. I'm like, heck, I'll be drunk by the time I do any of that. Will you be my sponsor? And that was, again, the grace of God. I hear that woman every day in my life. She would say things like, Wenda, there's no reason for you to go into a bar room to check on your friends. They're not your friends. There's no reason for you to ever go back into the bar rooms you went to shoot a game of pool. There's no reason for you to go to the liquor stores to buy scratch tickets or cigarettes or candy because it's liquor. There are convenience stores for that. Linda, I don't want you ever to take NyQuil at 60% alcohol. Don't drink vanilla. And I was like, who drinks vanilla? I didn't understand that directive at all. And I'm like, all right, I think we're safe with that. Never drank NyQuil, but we were safe with that. And I'm like, okay. She would say things like, call me before you drink, not after you drink. She would say things like, she believed in deflation of ego at depth. She didn't want me to share at meetings. So in Massachusetts, anyway, you can't share before 90 days. You shouldn't be sharing before 90 days. And usually your first year is at a detox because you can't do too much damage there. They're not really listening to you anyway. And so she said to me, don't think you have anything of value to share anywhere or with anyone. And I'm like, I'm reasonably intelligent. How could you say that to me? That was really insulting to me. And basically, she was telling me I was going to be spreading the mess and not the message. And she was right. I only knew about the mess. I didn't know anything about the message. She told me I could go to a step meeting. I could read from the book. God bless you. But I was never to share at a step meeting because I didn't know anything about the steps. You know, she is very different from how people get sober here. She also said things like, 8 and 9 are huge. And she didn't want me doing a 9-step without talking to her. And for her, she wanted at least a year or more of sobriety because she wanted it to have depth and weight. And back then, a lot of people would go off and do their 9th, and then they'd get drunk. And then it has no value. So she's like, she felt like I should know the tools and actually stay sober for a period of time and then go about making my amends. And that worked for me, you know. So I'm like, okay. And she would say things like, you can't dry off with a wet towel. And I'm like, that's not applicable in any manner. And I'm like, what does that mean? And she said, like, I couldn't get sober hanging out with people that didn't have any sobriety. I can't be hanging out with people with 30 days, even though I have 30 days, because they don't know anything. And left to our own devices, we will drink. I needed to hang out with people with time. I had nothing in common with people with time. I did that, and I sat very quietly because I was, like, hanging onto my seat and biting my nails and trying not to come unglued. And they're, like, having lives and laughing and having a good time. You know, they've got jobs, they've got kids, they've got houses. Life is skipping along for them. And I got nothing to contribute about, like, I just want to kill someone. So I learned to be quiet and just be in the company of people because there was no other way to get sober, you know, and they were safe. If I looked at one of them and said, I feel like drinking today, they're not going to say to me, I think we should go. They would probably say, let's go get a cup of coffee. And I've got countless stories where two people got together, were going on an outing like they were supposed to, a legitimate thing. One looked at the other and said, I want to get high today. And they did, and one almost died. So two wet towels. You know, you can't dry off with a wet towel. She told me things like, I don't hear any of this anymore. I don't hear any of the slogans anymore. You sit in the barbershop long enough, you're going to get a haircut. Stop going to the bar. Stop going to places that sell booze. Don't go to a place where you can't get yourself out of. Like if I was at my first funeral, my first wedding, drive yourself there, and if you're coming unglued, leave. But never put yourself in a situation where you can't leave an event when you're starting to come unraveled. And I did those things, you know. I'd make sure either who I was with, I could say, I got to go, or I would take my vehicle, and I got to go, and I'd go to a meeting. I can remember a friend of mine asked me to go with them to the wedding. He was a chronic relapser, and he had just had like 60, 90 days. He was in the wedding. He didn't want to drink. He didn't want to ruin his sister's wedding. He did all of the things, you know, and it's the reception, and I'm watching this waitress, and I had a bunch, well, not, but I had more time than him. He had like 60 days. I had a couple of years, 3-4 years. And I'm watching him watch the Budweiser go by on the waitress's tray. And I'm like, it's time to go. He's like, what do you mean? I'm like, you're not paying attention to anything but that Budweiser bottle going across. He's like, yeah, but it's my sister. I'm like, you've done everything you need to do. You've done the pictures. The wedding's over. The cake's been cut. This is the party. You don't need to be here. And we left. He relapsed a few days later. He was more interested in the booze than he was in being sober. But he tried. So I knew things like that. I didn't get myself into places where I couldn't get myself out of. And all of those things were incredibly important to me. And then we started to work on the steps. You know, step one, I had a hard time with all of the steps. I didn't believe I was powerless. My biggest thing is self-will and self-sufficiency. I'm driven by self-sufficiency. I'll do it all on myself. I got myself in it all. I got myself out of it. I can do this. I'll fix it. Whatever. It's been my mantra, my old idea, and it's been really hard to break that old idea. So when I got here, I had no God. I had no idea that I was fueled by self-sufficiency. I didn't understand anything about any of this stuff. So to be powerless, I refused to give in to the, that would mean, you know, self-sufficiency, no power. I was having none of that. Look up the word powerless. It says not to have power. I'm like, how is that helpful? You know, power is the lack of, our dilemma is the lack of power or whatever that statement is. And I'm like, no, that's not my problem. I don't understand that. And so I just hung on to the other part. I knew my life was unmanageable. I had two drunk drive-ins. I'm riding a bike. I'm working at a downtown law firm. My life's not going anywhere, right? I'm coming unglued because I can't drink. So my life isn't going anywhere. All right. My sponsor would say, if you don't get it, put it on a Rolodex card. It'll flip up. I'm like, okay, don't get that. Step two. Didn't get that because I thought it was the insane things I did when I drank. And I kind of liked that stuff. I kind of liked not knowing what was going to happen most times because a lot of times I had a lot of fun. Except for the last year. So I kind of didn't, like, understand that. But I didn't. If somebody had said back then, like, I hear it so simply now, it means the thought that precedes the first drink is the insane thought, like, God would restore me to sanity, that I can never drink in safety. But that's not how it was explained up there. It was really difficult. Like, I don't know. AA has evolved over the years I've been here. You know, turn my will and my life over to the care of God. Well, you know, I don't believe in God, so I'm turning it over to me, so we're going to have trouble right there. So, four, I did that, but I didn't understand. You know, we were doing Blueprint for Progress. It wasn't like out of the big book. You had all of these stupid, like, workbooks with all of these character defects. I couldn't even define them to understand them that I possessed them. And nobody could define them well enough for me to understand whether I had them or not. So, like, it ended up for me, my first fourth step was harms to others. I had hurt so many people, and I had such shame about it It was really my A step list, but I didn't know that. But it was harm to others. And I was sincere about all of the things I had done and hurt people. Did my fist up, didn't give that big secret up. Too much shame wrapped around that. You know, 6 and 7, back then, nobody knew anything. They just didn't. You know, they had no idea what 6 and 7 was. Nobody was really talking about it. They call it the forgotten steps, and they truly are. 8 and 9 was really easy. I put some time together. So, I'm 5 months sober. I decide, self-will, self-determined. My life's never going to change. I want to have a child. I set out to have a kid with the guy I'm with, who's his nutsy as I am, if not worse. I have a child. So at 5 months, I'm proceeding to have a child. It's not an accident. It is a decision I make. At 14 months, I'm delivering this beautiful little girl who's absolutely gorgeous, that I swear is the wrong child. It's blue-eyed, blonde and fair, long and leggy, nothing like me. She's all her dad and her dad's side of the family. I'm like, I thought I'd have all the dominant genes. Not one. But she's got alcoholism and drug addiction like me and her dad. So at 17 months, I'm loaded with fear. I have this kid. I'm running my life on self-will, and I'm drunk. So that's May. So it's March, May. So it's 2 months after my daughter's born. I'm drinking, and I'm drinking till about August 8th of 1989. And then I come back, and, like, I'm done. I have a black eye. I've got fingerprints around my throat. I've got this baby. I didn't grow up in an alcoholic home. I had been to hundreds of meetings where many women have lost their children because of alcoholism. I lived in this fear that I was going to lose my daughter. I didn't want to raise my child like that. I wasn't raised like that, and I was done. I was just done. And I came in, and life started to take off for me. You know, I came in like everybody else. So one of the things I was thinking about, like, I just wanted to read, I've been reading the 12 and 12 with a friend of mine, and this is just my own opinion, which could be totally wrong, but it says here on page 68 in step 6, therefore, it seems plain that few of us can quickly or easily become ready to aim at spiritual and moral perfection. We want to settle for only as much perfection as will get us by in life, according, of course, to our various and sundry ideas of what will get us by. So the difference between the boys and the men is the difference between striving for a self-determined objective and for the perfect objective, which is of God. And I wonder if, like, for me, like, I've seen people with, like, long-term sobriety go out, and I wonder if that's the deal, that they've stopped working on 6 and 7, that they have a self-determined objective, which means, to me, self-will, right? I've decided what I want and what I have to fix and the rest be damned with, where I lose my program. And I wonder if, like, when you look at 10, it's really 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9, right? That's what 10 is. And if you don't really focus here and focus on 6, and I start just determining what I want to give, and I can give you some examples. I was at one point making some decent money here, and my mother needed money. Now, I have pockets of money put in pockets of places because it's designed to go where I want to spend it. And if you know me, I love to travel. So I have a big pocket of money here that's traveling, and I don't want to give any of that money up. I have a pocket of money here, like, I have different accounts. That's to fix the house, to whatever. This is my checking account, and this might be my home savings account. So I have all these little pockets of money. My mother needs money. Now, I give her money, but in my head, I am sort of resentful, and I should not. That's self-determined objective. God's plan for me, I am sure, is to take care of my mother, who has given me thousands of dollars and paid for me to go to detox. She's never asked me for a dime, and she would tell me all the time, I would just throw it in her checking account, please stop. But for me, I was, like, begrudging in my head, and I still have a trouble, like, sharing my money. And that's a self-determined objective, because I've determined where I want that money to be spent. And it's not there. It's here. And so, like, I have to work on those things. And I have to give it up. And I can maybe be unhappy for a small amount of time. And I get over it. I talk to my sponsor about it. I know the right thing to do is to give it to her. And it would be better. And I don't give it to her begrudgingly to her. It's in my head. It would be nice if I just wanted to do it because that's who I am. And it would be a good thing, and it would make me smile. I'd be lying to you if I told you that was true. It's one of my defects, right? I don't want to share my money with you because I want to go to Europe. Another one is that my mom's older, and she lives in Massachusetts, and I adore my mother, and we're very close, and she thinks I'm fabulous, which I find kind of ironic, because all my life growing up, she would say things like, I don't like you very much, but I love you. So she couldn't stand being around me at all for a very long time. And I say this a lot when I speak. Every time I speak, I was around 2 or 3 years sober, and she would say, I don't know who that girl was, but my daughter's back. So I knew I had that psychic change, right? I had come home. So she's lonely. My dad died 6 years ago. She's lonely, you know. She has, you know, this pocket of, I call them the widows, there's four of them. They all lost their husbands within 2 years of each other. They go out and do stuff, but she's still very lonely, and she wants to see me all the time. So I try to go up every quarter. And I know my problem, like 6 and 7, is perspective. And I know when I'm saying these words, but it's how I feel. It's my perspective that needs to change. It's, so I'm saying to a friend of mine who's an AA, I hate coming up here. I feel I'm bored all the time because she, you know, she's 81. I don't know what it's like to be 81, but everything hurts, she says, you know, and so she doesn't really want to go here or do that. And I'm like, okay, this is not like, I want to kind of go see my friends from AA because that's where I get sober for like a long period, 20 years of my sobriety is in Massachusetts. I have all these friends that I still see. And then I feel like I should be here. So I was saying this to him as I was sort of complaining, as I was about sharing my money. And he said to me, and I'm like, I get I need to reframe this. So I understand, but this is how I feel. And he said, you're giving comfort by being with her watching TV. And you're giving company. And that's the way you need to look at it. And that's a noble thing. And that is why I go. But, you know, I still go. I do the right thing. I try not to be grumpy about it. But in my brain, I'm like, I couldn't be more bored. And I don't want to use my vacation time to go sit and watch TV with my mother. But he's right. I'm there to give comfort and to be with her and chat with her and to give her company. I always need to reframe the way I think. So like 6 and 7, like I get my character defects. And I get like I have to work on them, but I don't know that they go away, but I can do the right action, you know? I can do the right action even though it's contrary to maybe the way I'm feeling at the moment, you know? And that's not me. I really believe that's God, and I believe that's you. I learned those things here from you people, you know? And I think I really need to start like, and I have been, like looking at those things, like is that what causes people to slip? Like I stop working at like, I start running my life on self-will, right? The self-will is like, I'm not giving her any money even though she needs it because I'm going to Europe, you know? Or, you know, when people with long-term is that, besides not going to meetings, are they not really working like 6 and 7, which is what they're talking about, the things that separate me from you. That's what, to me, my defects do. It separates me from you and keeps me isolated. So I need to not do that. So I am part of a family. I'm part of AA. I'm part of my job as an employee. And I'm not just this island that I used to be everywhere in every sort of circle of life. And for me, if I start like running life on self-will, I'd be that island again. I wouldn't be doing the things I need to be doing to be part of a family, part of Alcoholics Anonymous, and part of my employment. And I couldn't keep a job. I could keep a job. But I would hop jobs every 2 years. I don't know why. But I would hop jobs. Like, I've been able to keep jobs for 13, 14, you know, 15 years now. Like, I had no longevity for anything before I came to Alcoholics Anonymous. None. I could start stuff, never finish stuff. You know, Alcoholics Anonymous did wonderful things for me and my family. You know, my dad died 6 years ago. It was a terrible time. I'm still baffled. My mother has known no other man. She's known him since the age of 17. They were together 60 years, married 55 or 54, 55 years. My dad was in an Alzheimer's wing. It was no surprise my dad was going to die, but it was like a shock to my mother, which totally baffled me. And she sort of checked out. She's like, you plan the funeral. I don't want any part. You know, go get the food for the dinner and you go do this and you go do that and I'll get flowers. And my mother has the patience of Job. There's nobody kinder. There's nobody more patient. I don't have any of that. I'm like my dad. I'm like a short fuse. I can be a cyclone and I can like wind me up. I can be a whirling dervish. My mom, no. She's very measured. She's very, very kind. And she's very loving. And I think that was the first time my mother was like really unkind to me when we were going to get flowers. It was immediately after my dad's death. Like immediately after my dad's death. And I was like, wow. I didn't say anything. And I was like, that's not. So a little while later, she's quiet. We're in the car. We're going to get flowers or something. And she's like, I'm really sorry. That was uncalled for. I shouldn't have said that or done that. And I'm like, it's fine, Mom. I get it. It's okay. And I was able to be there for her. You know, I ordered the dinner. I picked the rest. We did all of those things and took care of it. You know, she did the service and stepped up for a few things. But a lot of things she sort of just checked out for. You know, she just was grief-stricken. Like, I've never seen anybody grief-stricken. It was just heartbreaking. He was everything. Now, my mother's a smart woman. She always told me you can't make one person your whole life. Like, she has learned to move on and get past grief. But at the moment of my dad's thing, and she tells me that all the time, one person can't be your whole life, Linda. I don't care if you're married, you can't be your husband. You just have to have a community of people in your life. And she does, and she has always had. My mother's full of wisdom. I don't know where she got it from, but for whatever reason, us kids, it never transmitted to us. And so I understand that. But she grieved for a long time, and we let her grieve. And it took about 3 years. It was the worst, three worst Christmases I've ever had. I said to my husband, if we go up for the fourth and it's like this, I'm done. And it was the first time we laughed and we had fun. My mother's finally coming out the other side, you know. But it took her a long time, and we were patient. And we loved her, and we let her talk about it, and we let her cry, and we let her be sort of a bump on a log, you know. My husband would say a bump on a pickle. Until she could, you know, come out and find joy in living. And then she felt bad about finding joy in living because my dad was dead. It was just, it was crazy. But it was her journey to take and not mine. And I was able to be there. Now, I also thought, like, I was going to live life with no problems, right? I don't know why I thought that, but I thought it was all going to be sunshine. And, you know, I don't know what I was thinking. Like, what did I think? Like, my dad wasn't going to die. My mom's not going to die. But, you know, I've gone through many things in the years that I've been sober and managed to step up. And I have managed to mess up horrifically, even at, like, 27 years, I said something. I'm usually with my daughter, who's an active heroin addict, that I keep what I say really tight-lipped. And I had an expectation, and my daughter and my mom came here for Thanksgiving this particular year, and I had this vision, which was the biggest setup. I had this vision, and I wanted it to be perfect because I wanted them to come every year, and I go up for Christmas. It was going to be this new tradition. It was going to be wonderful, blah, blah, blah. It was horrific. My daughter's best friend, all of my daughter's friends, a lot of my daughter's friends, I shouldn't say a lot of, all of them, have died, either from heroin addiction, car accidents. And before my daughter got here, one of her friends that used to come in my house all the time, sit at my dinner table, died from a heroin overdose. My daughter checks out. She finds some boy. She checks out, and we can't find her. Now, I know better than to go looking for her. I know where she is, and my mama wants me to go find her. And we have cooked this magnificent dinner. I should have not gone and found her. And then some of the things that came out of my mouth were not very kind. And I was so sad. Because when you say things, you just can't take them back. And they leave such scars. And I have been so good from 16 to whatever it was 3 years ago, 27, about trying not to say unkind things, right? My kid's sick. But I'm mad now, and I said something that broke my heart. And, you know, today, as shameful as it was, I called my sponsor. I'm able to tell myself, but it took me a couple of years, like, to forgive myself. I make my amends, and she said I was. You know, she was, whatever I had said. And I'm like, but that's not what I should have said. And I'm really sorry, and I really can't take it back. But I didn't mean it. I was just angry. So I don't do this perfectly. I still sometimes react. I don't care how much time you have. It says, you know, progress. I'm not perfect. And so all I can do is try to be better. But it ate me up, I swear, for a couple years. You know, and it's not like I was like 10 years. I was 27 years sober when that happened. And now what? I'm heading towards 30 and I am still crying. I just felt awful. So I don't want to allude to you that I live this perfect life. I try to do it to the best of my ability. I make mistakes. I try to fix it when I can. I come to Alcoholics Anonymous so I can help somebody else. And I believe in the responsibility pledge. And I believe that it's my job, if somebody wants what I have, that I can show them what I know to do. You know, if nobody was here for me, I wouldn't be here today. And, you know, I'll end with this. Some of the greatest gifts I've got from Alcoholics Anonymous is people's time. When I came in, I had no idea, and I would have disputed this, and I know you're on the side to believe, but I was a crazy person. And I wouldn't have told you that. And so I can remember Jerry Champagne. So I didn't have a license. So Jerry Champagne and Mike Sullivan, they were roommates, would come and pick me up to take me to a meeting every night, almost every night. Or they'd find somebody. And so I remember one time Jerry was in my living room. He was sitting on the floor, and I was on the couch, and we were talking. And I was just a crazy person spewing just nuts, right? But I didn't realize that. He was so kind. He never said an unkind word. He never jumped in. He just listened. And I unloaded whatever it is I felt I needed to unload. And I remember that to this day. And Jerry died in a freak, you know, industrial accident at his job. And he was one of the greatest members I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous. I've had some of the nicest men help me in Alcoholics Anonymous and help me, because there's no one meaner in Alcoholics Anonymous to me than me. The stuff I say to myself and the way I carry on a conversations, and I need gentle. I look for gentle people, because Northerners are brash, and we're a bit abrupt and a bit blunt. So when I was looking for sponsorship, I was looking for the opposite of me, somebody that was kinder and gentler to help me be kinder and gentler with me, which took a long time. And I'll be forever grateful. I cannot tell you the joys I found here. You know, and just right living is enough. I've gotten a lot of other things, but living right and being at peace and be able to go to sleep at night and not have that whirling dervish that I used to have is a gift beyond measure, you know? Even though, you know, my mom's older and I don't always understand things, I can still show up and I can still maybe not be gracious in my head. I can express to somebody in Alcoholics Anonymous how I'm feeling and turn it around and do the right thing, you know? And that's the gift. I couldn't do any of that when I got here. I couldn't even show up to my grandmother's wedding, my grandmother's funeral. My dad's mother died. I was out getting drunk. I showed up late, sopping wet, and I can't tell you the level of disgust I saw from my parents that day. I haven't seen that in the last 20 years, 29 years. I haven't seen that at all. They want to be with me, and that is a blessing. And that's from you. Thank you.